On June 26, 1975, in the late morning, two FBI agents drove onto Indian land near Oglala, South Dakota, a small village on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Here, a shootout occurred in which both agents and an Indian man were killed. Although large numbers of FBI agents, Bureau of Indian Affairs police, state troopers, sheriff's deputies, and vigilantes surrounded the property within an hour of the first shots, the numerous Indians involved in the shootout escaped into the hills. The death of the agents inspired the biggest manhunt in FBI history. Of the four men eventually indicted for the killings, one was later released because the evidence was weak, and two others were acquitted in July 1976, when a jury concluded that although they had fired at the agents, they had done so in self-defense. The fourth man, Leonard Peltier, indicted on the same charges as his companions but not tried into the following year, after extradition from Canada, was convicted on two counts of murder in the first degree and sentenced to consecutive life terms in prison, even though his prosecutors would dismiss as worthless the testimony of the only person ever to claim to have witnessed his participation in the killings. This testimony was also repudiated by the witness, who claimed to have signed her damning affidavits under duress, as part of what one Court of Appeals judge would refer to as a clear abuse of the investigative process by the FBI. Whatever the nature and degree of his participation at Oglala, the ruthless persecution of Leonard Peltier has less to do with his own actions than with underlying issues of history, racism, and economics, in particular Indian sovereignty claims and growing opposition to massive energy development on treaty lands and the dwindling reservations. In the Northern Plains, the opposition was based on a treaty signed in 1868 between the United States and the Lakota Nation at Fort Laramie in Dakota Territory, which recognized Lakota sovereignty in their Dakota-Wyoming homelands and hunting grounds, including the sacred Pahasapa, the Black Hills. With the discovery of gold in the Black Hills a few years later, this treaty was illegally repudiated by the U.S. government. Not until the 1970s was the justice of the Lakota treaty claim recognized in court. That's the introduction to Peter Matheson's amazing book, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. It is the story of Leonard Peltier, and that's what we're talking about tonight on Native Solidarity News. Thanks for being along for this program. You've been hearing every week from Leonard's book, Prison Writings, My Life is My Sundance. Hope you enjoyed the excerpt read again by Gutsit Sakwas. What we're going to try and do with the show tonight is understand how he wound up in jail. And to do that, we need to understand some of those things that Pierre Matheson is talking about, namely history. And that's going to lead us up to a message from Leonard to Native Solidarity News listeners that was recorded thanks to the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. Now, this book, which, by the way, the In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, which is on Viking Penguin, and is now back in print after having been suppressed for 8 years in a libel suit, as you will hear about, tells the story from the beginning, and it starts in 1835. In 1835, five white prospectors who entered the old silences of the Sacred Mountains were attacked by Indians. Their fate was scrawled in a last note: all killed but me. Probably Ezra Kine's small expedition was the first to pursue the sunny glint of gold in the earth and streams of the Black Hills, an isolated ridge of Pine Ridge peaks and high blue lakes that rises strangely from dry plains on what is now the Wyoming-South Dakota border. This outcropping of ancient limestones and granite, roughly 40 by 120 miles, is considerably older than Mount Everest. It is as old, perhaps, as any geological formation in North America. Like any isolated mountain in flat country, it has a mystery and power, as if placed there as a sacred place at the center of the circle of the world. Or so it was perceived by the Cheyenne and the Arapaho, and later by the Seven Bands, or Council Fires, of the Lakota Oyate, or Western Dakota Nation, which was moving westward out of Minnesota, the land of many waters, in the course of a 200-year dispute with the woodland Ojibwa and the Cree. When the Lakota crossed the Missouri River, they abandoned the woodlands for a great free life on the open plains, hunting the buffalo with other Indian nations that had captured or stolen the horse. All of these people were drawn to the Dark Hills, a shelter and a hunting place for deer and birds and buffalo in winter, a source of stone implements and medicine plants and sparkling clear water. In the summer, in the time of the great tribal gatherings and renewal ceremonies such as the Sun Dance, the young man would go to sacred points in Pahasapa on the 4-day vision quest that would come from, that would form and guide their lives, the decision to meet oneself, Lakota has said. With the discovery of gold near Virginia City, Montana, in the early 1860s, public clamor increased for a safe trail from Cheyenne northward across the Powder River. Most of the soldiers were withdrawn to the Civil War, but military forays into Indian country recommenced soon after the war ended. In 1866, an expedition sent to open up the Bozeman Trail into Montana, called by the Indians Thieves' Road, was disputed at a council held at Fort Laramie, where Red Cloud, the Oglala war leader, refused to be presented to the officers, then stalked out in the midst of the discussions. The Great Father sends us presents and wants us to sell him the road, but the white chief comes with soldiers to steal it before the Indian says yes or no. The irascible, ambitious Red Cloud had been repudiated by many of his people because he had killed the head chief of the Oglala, declaring that Bull Bear was too friendly with the whites. But no one questioned Red Cloud's abilities as a war leader or as a statesman. His foremost ally was Spotted Tail, chief of the Brule Band, who had led a great raid in 1864 on Julesburg, Colorado. This raid reflected the widespread outrage among Plains Indians caused by the slaughter at Sand Creek of an unsuspecting Cheyenne camp by an armed mob of Colorado irregulars, with subsequent gross sexual mutilation of men, women, and children. In late 1866, Crazy Horse, a young Oglala warrior who had ridden with Spotted Tail to Colorado, led the skillful ambush and destruction of a cavalry detachment at Big Piney Creek on the Upper Powder River. The following year, when the Oglala were routed by the U.S. Army's new breech-loading rifles near the Bighorn River, the government had already had enough of Red Cloud's war and sued for peace with the Sioux Nation. According to the terms of the treaty signed by Red Cloud at Fort Laramie on November 6, 1868, the Indians were guaranteed, quote, absolute and undisturbed use of the Great Sioux Reservation. No person shall ever be permitted to pass over, settle upon, or reside in territory described in this article, or without consent of the Indians pass through the same. No treaty for the cession of any portion or part of the reservation herein described shall be of any validity or force unless executed and signed by at least 3/4 of all adult male Indians occupying or interested in same. In 1870, on the first of several trips to the east, Red Cloud and Spotted Tail became dismayed by the sheer numbers of the whites. The two leaders perceived that the defeat of their people was inevitable. The tracks into the Black Hills left by the supply wagons of Custer's expedition of 1,000 pony soldiers were later used by the gangs of gold-crazed miners who shot their way into the hills in defiance of the Indian war parties, burning the timber, muddying the streams, and killing off the game. The white man, as one Indian said, was in the Black Hills just like maggots. Wasiku, or the greedy one, was the term the Lakota used to describe the miners, and it later became their term for whites in general. The love of possessions is a disease with them, said Sitting Bull. In November 1875, the Secretary of War of the United States predicted trouble in the Black Hills unless something is done to gain possession of that section for the miners. Cheyenne was then wild with excitement concerning the Indian War, which all the old frontiersmen felt was approaching, and the settlement of the Black Hills, in which gold in unheard-of sums was alleged to be hidden. No story was too wild, too absurd, to be swallowed with eagerness and published as a fact in the papers of the town. Along the streets were camped long trains of wagons loading for the Black Hills. That year, a commission was sent out from Washington to treat with the Sioux Indians for the relinquishment of the Black Hills. Red Cloud and Crazy Horse of the Oglala refused to attend the proposed meeting, and so did Sitting Bull of the Hunkpapa. Since the Sioux were being so unreasonable, President Grant withdrew the soldiers who were supposed to keep the whites out of Pahasapa. By the winter of 1876, more than 10,000 whites were jostling for advantage in the raw mud streets of Custer City, the new frontier town in the southern hills. It was now widely proposed that the Black Hills be purchased from the Indians whether they liked it or not. If they chose to refuse $5 million, that was their affair. Early in 1876, in open contravention of the Fort Laramie Treaty, troops were sent into the Great Sioux Reservation in pursuit of those hostiles most likely to resist the voice of reason, especially Sitting Bull's Hunkpapa and the Oglala under Crazy Horse. By late spring, the hostiles had been joined by numerous Cheyenne and Arapaho, and also bands of Minicojou led by Hump and Lame Deer, together with a number of Blackfeet and Sans Arc. Though Indians question it, white historians declare that this was the greatest gathering of Indian people ever assembled. In the second week of June, a great sun dance was held at Medicine Rocks, in what is now Montana. Here, Sitting Bull sacrificed, then stood all day staring at the sun before he fell. In his vision, he saw the blue-jacketed soldiers falling backward into the Indian encampment. On June 16th, inspired by this vision, Lakota and Cheyenne warriors led by Crazy Horse made a successful raid upon Crook's forces. And on June 25th, on the windy ridge east of the Greasy Grass Creek, known to the Bluecoats as Little Bighorn, Crazy Horse and his men drove off an attack by Major Marcus Reno, then surrounded and exterminated another attacking column led by Colonel Custom, who had ensured his fate 2 years before by his transgressions on the sacred ground of Pahasapa. Within 10 years, the Oglala Lakota, led by Red Cloud and Crazy Horse, had been responsible for two of the three greatest defeats ever inflicted on the United States Army by Indians. And this last great Indian triumph in American history won the victors a cold retribution that has not relented to this day. Although forcible and illegal seizure of the Black Hills, already underway, had invited the disaster at Little Bighorn, the U.S. government now declared that the Fort Laramie Treaty was no longer valid, due to the Indians' warlike behavior. 2 weeks after the defeat, the New York Times reported that certain high officers in the War Department were advocating a policy of extermination of the Indians. The speedier the better. Within 2 months, it was formally decreed that the Sioux must relinquish all claim to the Black Hills. They were rounded up and confined to the vicinity of the Bluecoats' forts, where their ponies and rifles were confiscated by the soldiers. In August, yet another commission was sent out with documents designed to establish United States ownership of Pahasapa in an orderly and legalistic manner. Farther west, Sitting Bull's hunting grounds on the Tongue River had been invaded by soldiers under General Nelson Miles, who had tracked down and killed Chief Lame Deer that same year. In the knowledge that he and Crazy Horse had been abandoned by the reservation chiefs, Sitting Bull, with the Oglala war chief Gull and several hundred people, retreated northward and crossed into Canada in February 1877. With Sitting Bull in Canada, Crazy Horse became the last great figure of resistance. In September 1877, he was summoned to Fort Robinson, Nebraska, where he was fatally stabbed under disputed circumstances. That same year, George Hearst's Homestake gold mine was established at Lead in the Northern Hills. Within 2 years, Homestake appeared on the New York Stock Exchange, and within 10, an investment of $10,000 was worth $6 million, $1 million more, that is, than had been offered by the commissioners for all of the Black Hills. On December 15th, 1890, Sitting Bull, like Crazy Horse before him, was killed while resisting arrest for fomenting trouble, so they said. Bigfoot, now the leading traditional chief, set out with his people on a long winter trek across the Badlands, seeking safety with Red Cloud's people on Pine Ridge. 2 weeks later, on December 29th, when Bigfoot and 200 or more Minicoju men, women, and children, with a few fugitives from Sitting Bull's Hunk Papa Band, were slaughtered by the 7th Cavalry at Wounded Knee, Custer's avenged regiment received 20 Congressional Medals of Honor from a grateful government. After Wounded Knee, the soldiers were replaced by bureaucrats, including educators, whose official task was to break down the cultural interdependence and independence of the people. On pain of imprisonment, the Lakota were forbidden the spiritual renewal of traditional ceremonies, even the ritual purification of the sweat lodge. They were not permitted to wear Indian dress or to sew beadwork. Their children were seized and taken away to government boarding schools at the Pine Ridge Agency, and the use of their language was discouraged. Welcome back to Native Solidarity News here on your local community radio station, telling the story of Leonard Peltier and the Lakota Nation. We heard some of the story from the first appearance of the settlers looking for gold and so on in the 1830s to Wounded Knee Massacre in 1890. The book now jumps forward to tell the story of the American Indian Movement, which is very much the context in which Leonard Peltier emerged. Just want to remind you that we are going to come around and talk about the specifics of Leonard's case and the reasons why so many people around the world believe that he should be unconditionally liberated from jail after 24 years But to do that, have to explain the whole thing, and in the process, hopefully, this will shed light on other stories that you may hear about, native rights issues, fishing rights, for example, all the land rights movements, and so on. So the story picks up in the 20th century. The book, by the way, is called In the Spirit of Crazy Horse by Peter Matheson. In 1962, in Minnesota's Stillwater State Prison, two Ojibwa inmates, Clyde Belcourt and Eddie Benton Benai, excited by the Indian protest that was being heard here and there around the country, concluded that government supervision was destroying the Indian people, and that Indians had to deal with their own problems if they were to survive. In July 1968, with Eddie Benton Benai, George Mitchell, and another ex-convict named Dennis Banks, Belcourt founded the Concerned American Indians. This name, because of its acronym, was speedily changed to the American Indian Movement. There has always been an American Indian movement, Belcourt has said. For hundreds of years, there have been people like Crazy Horse who stood up and fought for us. Although much of its inspiration derived from Indian fishing rights battles already underway in Washington and Oregon, from Six Nations land protests in Ontario and New York, and from the Red Power activity that had evolved out of civil rights activism on the West Coast, AIM came into existence as a direct result of the termination and relocation programs that dumped thousands of bewildered Indians into the cities. Even those who received job training found themselves faced with open racism and discrimination, receiving the lowest wages for the dirtiest, most onerous work, and living in the worst conditions of urban blight and official neglect. In its first year, AIM's main concerns were jobs, housing, and education. In addition, Belcourt set up a street patrol to protect Indians from police abuse and violence. Inevitably, AIM was accused by disillusioned state and municipal authorities of teaching a hate-whitey attitude in its school. Meanwhile, the John Birch Society attacked the new movement as a nest of ex-convicts and commie ex-convicts at that. But AIM had caught the imagination of young Indians in a way that the earlier activist groups had not, and soon AIM organizers and local partisans were turning up at demonstrations from coast to coast. One of these was the Indians of All Tribes' occupation of the abandoned federal penitentiary on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay, led by young Mohawk Richard Oakes. Grace Thorpe, and the Tuscarora medicine man Mad Bear Anderson. This action by perhaps 200 Indians was supported by white liberals in San Francisco and lasted from November 1969 until June 1971. Leonard Peltier's first experience with AIM-style confrontations was the 1970 takeover of Fort Lawton outside Seattle, which, like Alcatraz, was on so-called surplus federal land, to which the Indians had first right under the law. Now, this part of the book by Peter Matheson, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, goes on to tell the story of other AIM activities. Fort Lawton, there were actually arrests made, even though it was within the U.S. law. In 1972, there was the four-mile-long caravan of cars to Washington, known as the Trail of Broken Treaties, with a 20-point plan for respect of ancient treaties, including the Treaty of Fort Laramie of 1868, still considered to be in force, as all other treaties are to this day, at least by the First Nations who signed them. Also, there was that led to the takeover of the Bureau of Indian Affairs building, and promises to have the demands dealt with, which were never fulfilled. Also, in 1973, in response to yet another unsolved murder of a Native person, Wesley Bad Heart Bull and also Raymond Yellow Thunder before him, there was a takeover of a Bureau of Indian Affairs building at Wounded Knee, and that led to a 73-day standoff with FBI and other U.S. Police and military attacks, and there was, however, an investigation into the Wounded Knee occupation, and I should mention also that to this day there are still problems of unsolved murders everywhere and uninvestigated murders. That is what the white clay occupation that you might be hearing about on Native Solidarity News or elsewhere is all about. A couple of killings that have not been investigated, and the climate of impunity that reigns in these places, also the incredible poverty. Pine Ridge, where this story takes place, is just about the poorest place on the entire continent, in Canada and the U.S. And that brings us, it's also a place where in between 1973 and 1976, the tribal government of Dick Wilson had the so-called Reign of Terror with its own paramilitary squad known as the Guardians of the Oglala Nation, or Goons, who killed at least 63 political activists, AIM people and otherwise, at Pine Ridge. And there has still been no investigation into that period. The tribal council systems anywhere being basically a setup of the federal governments to replace traditional native self-determination with a kind of elected-style government, often staffed and always financed by the feds. And the situation is the same in Canada, and that is the avenue to getting the access to the land and the resources. Dick Wilson was actively trying to profit from the sale of resources on Lakota land at Pine Ridge. There were interests for the uranium, coal, prospects of gold mining, and so on. And that is why trouble came down on Pine Ridge in 1975, almost 99 years to the day after the attack on Custer by Crazy Horse. That's where we get into understanding how Leonard Peltier wound up in jail beyond all of the background. We're going to get into the specifics, which really isn't going to take that long, because on the day before the shootout at Oglala, Richard Wilson of the Tribal Council awarded custody to the U.S. government of a large tract of Indian land in the northwestern region of the Pine Ridge Reservation. Under the circumstances, the FBI raid that took place the next day has been widely interpreted as a diversion tactic to distract attention from Wilson's action, which was unlawful according to the clause of the 1868 treaty specifying that 3/4 of all adult males had to approve any transfer of Lakota land. Others went further. The raid was an open provocation designed to invite fire from the Indians and thereby provide the excuse to move a paramilitary force onto the reservation and make an all-out attack on AIM and its supporters. Now, that raid was by Jack Collar and Ron Williams of the FBI on June 25th, 1975, supposedly looking for Jimmy Eagle for the theft of a pair of used cowboy boots. By coincidence, the BIA SWAT team was on maneuvers on near the Jumping Bull property on the day of the shootout. And perhaps it was also coincidence that, according to Edgar Bear Runner, paramilitary forces had been surrounding the Oglala region all that morning. There were an estimated 20 Indian police and goons on Highway 18, about 3/4 of a mile east of the property where the shooting took place. Within another 1/4 mile, there was a force of 150 white men, state troopers, U.S. Marshals, SWAT teams, and by late afternoon at least 250 were surrounding the area. Bear Runner's account of the size of the operation was confirmed by the New York Times, which reported that FBI agents and armaments were being airlifted from Denver, Minneapolis, Chicago, and even Quantico, Virginia, within hours of the first shots fired that day. The Indians claimed that part of this force was already in the area when Kohler and Williams drove onto the property, and within a remarkably short time, reinforcements arrived that can only be called massive, which when set against a band of untrained men and boys, armed mostly with a 30-30 deer rifles and 22s. There's no easy way to summarize what happened on June 26th, or how it happened. What happened is that Agents Kohler and Williams and Joe Kilsreich Stuns of the Lakota were killed in gunfire, and there was 4 people who were sought for the killings of the agents. There has not been an investigation into Joe Stuns' killing. Those 4 people are Jimmy Eagles, Bob Robidoux, Dino Butler, and Leonard Peltsy. Now, the first 3 were captured. Jimmy Eagle was, the case against him was dismissed because there was basically no evidence. Dino Butler and Bob Robidoux went on trial at Cedar Rapids in 1976 and were found not guilty on the grounds of self-defense. Leonard Peltsy escaped to Canada. On February 6, 1976, a Royal Canadian Mounted Police Inspector named Edward Mitchell received a call after midnight in his motel at Whitecourt, Alberta, instructing him to go to Hinton, 160 miles west of Edmonton, to organize a search for a Mr. Peltier. The search was unnecessary, since an informer had apparently told police just where to go. That day, Mitchell and his Mounties proceeded to the remote camp of a Cree leader named Robert Smallboy, who'd occupied this place in a peaceable takeover a few years before. In a document leaked to the Willing Press, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had warned the citizens about a dangerous AIM-inspired Indian movement, part of an international terrorist conspiracy which sought social and economic equality for Canada's Indians, as well as just recognition of their land claims. The Red Power movement, the police declared, quote, has become the principal threat to Canadian stability. Established in the late 19th century as a military force to remove Indians from prairie lands coveted by the settlers, the Mounties have never outgrown the idea that Indians, in the main, are a verminous nuisance. In recent years, a Chilcotin Indian named Fred Quilt was stomped to death by 2 RCMP officers in British Columbia in a killing that an all-white jury dismissed as accidental. This beefy side of Mountie nature is very familiar to Canada's Indians, if not to the white public. Accustomed as it is to postcard Mounties guarding the Dominion in World War I hats and red tunics astride huge horses by the shores of Lake Louise. In fact, the Mounties were only too eager to cooperate with their American colleagues in bringing to justice this cop-killing Aborigine, who was sought by the United States with the same fervor that Sitting Bull had been sought a century before. Small Boy's Camp was a makeshift congregation of small cabins and portable one-room schoolhouses donated after the occupation by the provincial government. In one of the schoolhouses, at about 3 in the afternoon on February 6, 1976, the fugitive was found sitting near the blackboard. And that fugitive, of course, was Leonard Peltsy. at Peltier's extradition hearings, pleas to the Canadian government by lawyers, friends, and family that the FBI was engaged in a systematic repression of AIM and that Peltier's life would be in danger if he was denied political asylum were countered by the Wisconsin so-called attempted murder charge, which propped up the weak Oglala evidence. That attempted murder charge was ostensibly for threatening a police officer in Wisconsin, for which Leonard got a beating. But the fatal blow to Leonard's hopes of avoiding extradition were two surprise documents in which a first-hand witness identified Peltier as the unassisted killer of Collar and Williams. In two affidavits, dated February 23rd and March 31st, 1976, this witness declared that she had accompanied Peltier to Oglala in May 1975, that Peltier and others began planning on how to either kill FBI, U.S. government police, or BIA agents who might come into the area. Peltier was most in charge of the killing. "I was present on the day the FBI agents were killed," she said. "I saw Leonard Peltier shoot the FBI agents." In another surprise affidavit, an FBI agent claimed to have found in the open trunk of Collar's car a .223 shell casing linked to the killer's rifle and matched by an FBI ballistics expert that to an AR-15 rifle that other witnesses had apparently associated with Leonard Peltier. Leonard Peltier was extradited to the United States and he went on trial at Fargo in 1977 in pretty much an all-white town with an all-white jury. And that had been a surprise choice given the conviction hearings for Rubidoux and Butler in the much nearby Cedar Rapids, nearby to Pine Ridge the year earlier. This is from the court record, the cross-examination of Myrtle Poorbear, who was the person who gave those testimonies, the eyewitness testimony of Leonard Peltier killing the two FBI agents. "Why were you signing these affidavits?" "I don't know." "Well, did Bill Wood threaten to harm you or hurt you if you didn't sign?" No response. "Can you answer the question?" "Your Honor, I'd like the court to reflect a 45-second pause measured by the courtroom clock between the last question and the following question. Can you answer the question, Myrtle?" "I was forced to sign both of these papers." "By whom?" "They said one of my family members was going to be hurt if I didn't do it." "By Dave Price and Bill Wood." Now, the jury was not allowed to hear that testimony. That was in camera. Neither did the jury or judge know about an FBI teletype dated October 1975, so years before the trial, that, quote, .223 casings not identifiable with AR-15 rifle. So, despite this, all this information coming out by Freedom of Information Act requests in the United States, Leonard Peltier is still in jail. He's had many appeals all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they've consistently been denied, as has parole. He will tell you now, in his own words, of his condition, health, and somehow managing to keep his spirit, as you've heard in his book, Prison Writings. This is Native Solidarity News. Yeah. This is the story of Leonard Peltier, and we'll tell you about the campaign for his liberation by executive clemency. That is the only way he's going to get out. There is nothing else that can be done by the courts, and the way to do that is the President of the United States, Bill Clinton, and being an election year, who knows whether they will toss a candy out there to get a few votes. The fax number and the email number for the president's office are coming up in just a moment, so go get a pen and paper if you want to support the Executive Clemency Campaign for Leonard Peltier. This is Leonard, recorded a year ago, a message to Native Solidarity listeners recorded for the show by the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee.
I'm okay as far as I'm aware. I mean, I don't quite know what's going on inside of my body, of course, but because of the medical complications that I have, the end results could be very serious.
Can you tell us about what's going on with your jaw problem and the surgery you underwent in 1996?
Well, I went down there to have my jaw fixed from what's called tendonitis. It used to be called lockjaw. And so they could repair my teeth. Some of my teeth were decaying. I couldn't get in there to drill, so they decided to fix my jaw. The first operation done in April was unsuccessful, so he wanted to try another method. And on May, I don't know, you're going to have to, what's that date, May 4th?
I believe so.
We'll make sure find it correctly.
Okay.
Which they told me that was only going to be a half an hour to 45 minute operation. And that started at 7:30 in the morning, didn't finish till 2:30 that afternoon. I started hemorrhaging. I lost a lot of blood. They had to give me a blood transfusion. And I was in a coma in intensive care for 14 hours, over 14 hours.
We were told that they put you in the hole afterwards. Is that true?
Yes, they told me that I needed radiation to stop the bone from growing. And the only way they would do that, because they had to take me out of the prison every day to give me the radiation shots, they had to keep me in total isolation. Isolation.
So right up. How is your, that was in 1996, how is your health today and your jaw today?
My jaw is frozen open at about a quarter of an inch, approximately, and I can't chew my food, I can't open it or close it any wider than that, it's frozen open right there, and I'm eating, only the way I'm chewing my food is with my tongue. And as everyone knows, that what the medical society recommends, that you chew your food real good so that it digests in your stomach, so that it lay dormant in your stomach, especially meats. If they lay dormant in your stomach for an amount of time, then that's what causes disease. So.
Will the prison prepare you a special diet so that you'll be able to digest your food properly?
Nope. No, they will not. I've asked numerous times at the hospital, and somebody in administration is denying it. The doctors have recommended it here at Leavenworth, somebody. The higher administration denying.
What helps you to survive? I imagine painting is part of it, and what helps you to keep hope?
Thousands and millions of people out there that are supporting, that believe in me, that believe in my people's struggle, that are aware of my people's history, and that are committed and dedicated to help get me out of prison. That plays a major role in keeping one's spirits high, up and high, Plus, I have my religious activities. Every Saturday, I'm allowed to go to the sweat lodge. And, hope, I guess.
What have you lived your life fighting for?
Justice for Native Americans. The return of treaty rights. We want the government to honor the treaty rights with us. To retain our sovereignty as a nation and as a people. And to be able to be, become self-determined. And self-sufficient. And to be who the Creator put us here as a state of people in this land.
Leonard Peltier on Native Solidarity News. Now, that was about a year ago. He's still sitting in jail, and the heavy labor still continues. You heard just a little bit of an inkling of the results of all the beatings he's gotten, and also negligence for treatment of his jaw, which was a condition he's had since his childhood. And yet, so much force of conviction and gentleness too comes out from him, and in his writings too, from prison writings, My Life is My Sundance, that you've been hearing on this show every week as part of what we can do to try and get the word out there about one person's story that tells the story of so many other people, and pressure for his liberation by executive clemency. The contact numbers for the President's office at the White House are by fax 202-456-2461, by email president@whitehouse.gov, and the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee in Lawrence, Kansas can be reached at the following number, 785-842-5774. Thank you for being with us for this very special show of Native Solidarity News in support of the liberation of Leonard Peltier and the end of the incarceration of all Native political prisoners and in general, as the connection is made, even the kind of incarceration that happens in the poverty of the reservations. Let it go, let it go, let it go.